Very good. So for tonight's talk, I did have a couple of suggestions. One I've received quite a long time ago, almost 6 months ago, but never got around to answering it. And it was about a young man who was married with children, a happy marriage, but he really wants to become a monk. So what should he do? What's the ethics? What's the karma of that? And the other question which was asked just before I came in here was that someone was again concerned about developments in the United States where things like abortion laws are becoming tighter and more of a problem. What is actually the karma of abortions and euthanasia, which is being discussed again in Victoria? And so this is a little talk on those aspects of karma where you have to make very difficult ethical decisions and how you can make those decisions. And it is marvelous, at least I was very helped, which is how I was trained as being a monk, not to actually tell people what decision they could make, but to allow people to gain wisdom and help so they can make those decisions for themselves. Because as I always felt, ethics should be a personal choice, not something which is imposed upon you by some government, whether it's a government of a temple or a religion or of a country. Sometimes you say, what right has people to make decisions in what is a very difficult situation to find a way through ethically? And of course, I've often mentioned that all the leaders of religions mostly are men. All the leaders of the government are mostly men. And what right do men have to tell a woman about her development of a fetus in the womb? Quite basically that we don't have enough experience, honestly. It's a bit sort of hypocritical for men to assume this great ethical superiority that we can tell women how to look after their bodies. It doesn't make any sense. In the same way that, you know, I was a heterosexual man, I don't have any right to tell gay, lesbian, transgender and the rest exactly how they should look after their lives, because it's hard to find empathy. I try my very best, and very often when I talk to people, you really try very hard to listen very deeply. It's something which you can develop as a meditator. When somebody is talking to you about these very difficult decisions they make in life, the first thing, you must always put aside all your dogma, your views, even your religious training. It's such an important thing. Never, as I said last week, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Because so much, all that we have learned, all that we have been told, all that we have heard is right or wrong, all of that is actually not that accurate. It is just approximations which we make into something far too solid. Instead, put all that aside and feel the right or the wrong of the situation, because people always say that it doesn't feel right, or this feels wrong. And so often when I've been asked to make those decisions or help people make the decisions, I say, look, please, for goodness sake, take your awareness, your mindfulness, down from your head into your heart, feel it. But there is a blockage there with making these ethical decisions. And that blockage is mostly because of fear again. I did talk about fear a couple of weeks ago, but I never got on to how fear is something which blocks us making really good decisions in life. So we don't really, you know, act out of kindness or wisdom or out of, you know, the greater good. So often we're afraid. So we make a decision which we think I won't be blamed for. I make a decision which I won't get into trouble for. We're so afraid of what other people think of us, which is one of the reasons why that we don't make good decisions in life. As for me, a long time ago, I didn't give a damn what other people think of me, which is why you can go around dressed like this. And even today, not so much in Perth, because people understand who you are, but in other countries, people ask, why are you going around wearing bedsheets? Why are you wearing skirts? It is a bedsheet, because this doubles as a bedsheet. This evening, when I go to sleep at night, this is the first cloth which I cover my body with. You know, it's amazing just how efficient you can be. Your bedsheet is your cloth. And I've also mentioned to you before, if you remember, because tomorrow morning I'll be traveling again, flying off to Malaysia to give some talks, and everybody keeps on asking me, well, there are terrorists, aircraft sometimes crash into mountains, that's a bomb, aren't you afraid? And I say, no, I'm not afraid, because this robe also doubles as my parachute. It's very resourceful, and last of all, when I was flying to UK in October, people said, well, what happens if you parachute out and you land in the Middle East? In Syria? Under ISIS? They take one look at you. Number one, you're infidel. Number two, you're white. I'd be the first to get my throat cut. Aren't you afraid? And I said, not at all, because I've got it all worked out. My robe again will protect me. All I really need to do is to cut a little slit in here, put it up over my head, and it becomes my burqa. So this is why this robe is so useful in so many different ways. But except that, you know, it doesn't fit into places. But I have really great fun with my robe. What's one of the other stories? You know, as a monk, I'm just going totally off tangent here, but I love going off and off subject, because I get into some really interesting jobs in my life as a monk. Sometimes people think monk's life must be so boring. You don't do anything, sit in the monastery, meditate all day. No way. I get some very amazing invitations. A few years ago, we had the Melbourne Commonwealth Games, if you remember that. And so Her Majesty the Queen of England came to Australia. And being a leader of the Buddhist religion here in Australia, I got an invite to go, number one, to do this interfaith service at St. Andrew's Cathedral, I think it's called, in Sydney. And then to go to a reception in Kirribilli House with the Majesty. Actually, I don't mind saying this. When I went to Kirribilli House with a reception, it was not just Queen Elizabeth II was there, also Prince Philip was there, and also Prince Edward was there as well. And because Prince Edward is a big shot, but because his mum and dad were there, they were the center of attention. And I was with another monk, Ajahn Sujato, many of you may know him. He stayed a while here, another monk from Perth. And with him, the two of us went there because they said Ajahn Brahm and what's it called, a partner. I don't have a partner, so I just take a monk. That's good enough. He's not my partner, but, you know, gives him a free gig. He's interested in going to do that. So, and actually he told me that, you know, he had a sort of a toothache the day before, and so he rang his dentist and he said, look, I really need to come and see you. And the dentist replied to him, look, I'm very, very busy. It's really important. How important? I'm going to meet the Queen of England tomorrow. Okay, come. It's a good excuse. So we went there, and everyone was talking to Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, and this Prince Edward, he was by himself. So I said to Ajahn Sujato, let's go and talk to this guy. So I went over to him, and typical Ajahn Brahm, making stupid jokes, because if you notice, he's actually, you know, losing a lot of his hair. And so I went out to him and said, you know, if you lose any more of your hair, you'll have to become a Buddhist monk like me and my friend. Ha, ha, ha. And he chuckled and we walked away. And Ajahn Sujato said, who was that? And I said, that was Prince Edward. What?
Ajahn Brahm, I'm not going with you anywhere again. You embarrass me every time. I don't mind. It's only a human being like anybody else. But anyway, the other gig which I went to, there was amazing. Here in Perth, you got this beautiful invitation card. This was to a state dinner in the Grand Hall of Parliament House in the presence of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II of Australia and Prince Philip. What an invite. What a gig to go to. And in fact, you know, that was, we're talking about this in the monastery a few days ago. That's when I went to the toilet, you know, the men's urinals, you know, you stand next to each other. And I was standing next to Lachlan Murdoch. I was kicking myself, why didn't I take a donation envelope? Lachlan Murdoch, urinating together. Well, not quite together, but, you know, adjacent. But anyway, just getting in there was a problem because on the invitation card, dress code. This is a big gig, not like coming to the Buddhist Society of an evening. Dress code there. So the dress code, I looked at it. First option, black tie. And that's what I thought. Is that all you wear? Just a tie? I mean no trousers? No shirt, just a tie. This is really kinky in Parliament House. And then, because I'm a mug, I don't usually get these invitations, and they said, no, black tie. It's like code. It means like a nice suit and the trousers and everything and a white shirt and a black tie. Not just only a black tie. So, okay, we don't have any ties at all in the monastery. So, no, don't have a tie to wear. So I can't go like that. So what else do you have? And the second thing on the dress code was military uniform. And imagine a monk like me going in a military uniform. I'm a pacifist. We're Buddhists. We don't do wars. So, okay, no military uniform. What's the third choice? And when I saw the third choice, my eyes went wide. Yes, I can do this. I can go. Long dress. Well, it is long dress. Have a look at it. So, that's how I went. As soon as I got in, stopped by security. Security stopped me. Come over here, sir. You know, are you allowed to be here? You know, your dress code. See, long dress. I had the invitation. Long dress, you see, long dress. This is my invitation. Ajahn Brahm Wangso. So they let me in. I don't care what people think of you, but that's a problem with fear. We're always afraid what people think of us once we make a decision. And also, we exaggerate, you know, what might go wrong afterwards. And it's fear is one of the biggest problems here. We can't make a clear decision when we're run by fear. Especially the fear of what other people would say about us. So again, that's not something you should ever think about if, you know, a person is married and they're thinking of, you know, leaving the world, becoming a monk. Just don't act out of fear, because then it's totally irrational whatever decision you make. Or even like, you know, things like an abortion or euthanasia or any other big decision you make in life. Please put fear aside as soon as you possibly can. Because that is what really bends, perverts, and messes up much of the decision-making you've had in your life. How many times has fear dominated your choice and you've regretted it afterwards? You said, why didn't I give that a try? Why didn't I give that a go? Who knows what might have happened? But because of fear, you don't act at all. So, but you have obviously to be responsible. As a man, a husband, you've got responsibility to your wife and your kids, and that's an important part of Buddhism. It's not an irresponsible religion at all. I have lots of responsibilities, you know, to all the monks, which, you know, I'm their teacher, I ordain them, I've got to look after them for the rest of my life. they're supposed to look after me, but there's more of them than there are of me, so I have to do more looking after of you guys than you'll ever have to look after me. So that's quite a responsibility. They are like, your children. They're my babies. Okay, they may be the same age as me, but they're my babies. look after, make sure they're well looked after and taught and everything else. That's to say, that's one of the reasons I have to go to Malaysia tomorrow morning, because my babies have been spending so much, I need to go and get some more money for more of my talks overseas. I said I should hide the credit card before I leave and take away the checkbooks. No, it's all stuff which needs to be done, but it takes a lot to look after. I've got a big family. Now, you may think you've only got just a wife and two kids. Crikey, I don't know how many kids have I got? 22 monks and I don't know how many, 11 nuns to look after. It's a big family. Anyway, but there's a story which I recall, written in a book a long time ago, a Buddhist story, about a person in a similar situation. There was a Burmese man who had a wife and kids, but he got so inspired, he really wanted actually to try out this monastic life. And it is a very inspiring, beautiful lifestyle. I really recommend it, not just for men, for women as well. We've got this beautiful nuns monastery in Dharamsala now, so it's fair, open for everybody. And I can understand, because I just really love this lifestyle. I was telling somebody a few days ago, interviewing me for another book, about my experience when I first became a monk in Bangkok. And I woke up with nightmares the first 4 or 5 nights. I woke up with a sweat, a nightmare. But my nightmare was that I was not a monk, that I was a layperson. And as soon as I opened my eyes and saw those brown robes next to, on the floor where I was sleeping, I realized I was a monk. I got this beautiful joy inside me, and I closed my eyes and went into a very peaceful, deep sleep. That was actually psychologically how deep my love of being a monk was. But, that's my experience, nightmares of thinking I wasn't a monk in my first few days. So it is a very beautiful lifestyle. And many people, sometimes I thought we should go to the universities on careers days. And so, become a Buddhist monk! Well, it's true, the pay is no good. Work very hard. Workplace conditions are not so good. Sleeping on the floor, eating out of your bowl. But the retirement benefits are out of this world, literally. And a lot of job satisfaction as well. But it's this particular man in Burma. He realized you just can't just abandon your wife and kids. So he said, right, this is my plan. I will work doubly hard. Won't spend anything on myself. Put lots of money aside, however much I can save. And so when my kids are grown up and gone to reasonably good schools and universities or whatever, and then my wife can have enough money to be looked after, in the latter part of her years. And that's what he did. He worked really, really hard for about 20 years until he could achieve his goal, that he could actually leave the family and go off in the last part of his life, to develop the spiritual path, full on as a Buddhist monk. And only a few weeks after he became a monk, he got fully enlightened with psychic powers. And this was such a shock to all the other monks. Other monks, they've been in that business for years. They hadn't got so far. And this guy comes off from the village and just becomes a monk. 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, he's fully enlightened. What's going on? And that's where they asked him, what have you been doing all this time? And even though he was working really hard, number one, he was being selfless. Not thinking about himself, but thinking others, doing service, but that was for his family. Really doing a lot of letting go. And because he was letting go that much, really sort of not worried about his own body, his own mind, obviously, just caring enough for it to be healthy, he'd let go and abandon so much, renounce so much, that when it came time, now he was a monk, all that momentum of letting go had built up, and it's just so easy to take that next step into deep meditation and also just full enlightenment. So WizKid. And that was actually a marvelous story of just, yes, you know, you are, you've got your responsibilities, but if you look at your responsibilities in a wise way, in a Dharma way, they're actually not impediments, you know, for your practice. It's not what you do, but the attitude you have to what you do is most important. Just like I keep on saying, it's not the meditation object you're focusing on, it's how you focus on it. That is crucial to develop deep meditation. So he had this idea, it's nothing about me, it's not about just me wanting stuff, I'm just giving, giving, working hard so that other people can eventually, my family can live comfortably. And because he abandoned his ego, his sense of self so much, it was very quick for him afterwards. And at the same time, he fulfilled his responsibility towards others. So if this guy who asked that question is listening, my advice is usually, but it's only advice, it's never, I'm not the Pope, I'm not infallible. You don't go around telling people, this is what you should do. And if you don't do this, you're going to be in big trouble. You won't be able to come into this center ever again. I did try that once. I told some of my disciples, don't ever listen to what I say. And they were just so stubborn, they listened to what I was saying and stopped listening. So, that was a joke, by the way. Didn't go down very well. Okay, I'll put it another way. Don't follow what I say. And they followed what I say by not following what I say. Is that any better? No, okay, I'll give up. Okay, what was it in Life of Brian? Tell us something inspiring, they asked Brian in that great movie. And Brian said, you are all different. And they all replied, we are all different, in unison. Is that any better? No, okay. Anyway. We go back to that responsibility to actually to responsibility is part of letting go. Letting go of what I want, how I want to do it, in my time frame. Letting go of what we call controlling. Letting it go. And if you don't understand what I'm saying, this is my old story. I told this again to a guy who was interviewing me. It's how to get some stillness so you can find out the truth of things. Glass of water. How can I hold my glass of water perfectly still? Is it stopped moving yet? It is moving. Why? Because I'm not paying any attention. You have to be mindful. So now I am mindful of my glass of water. Has it stopped moving yet? No, it's moving. Why? Because I'm not concentrating. So now I concentrate and mindful. And every time I do this and concentrate, it moves more. Because this is not what Buddhism is all about. It's not about being mindful and concentrating. It's all about letting go, putting it down, not grasping, not controlling, not manipulating yourself or the people around you. And when you let things go, put them down, stop worrying about them. What happens? That water's perfectly still. Honestly, I don't tell a lie. Perfectly still. Now, that is why when you do your service, you let go of what you want, you just do what needs to be done, you find that that creates the stillness. So the person who's talking about, you know, should I just abandon my wife and kid and just go off into the monastery, go off into the caves on the top of the mountains and meditate and become enlightened, it won't work. You've got responsibilities and duties, and by abandoning them, you're showing that you're a control freak. Instead, just do your duties as much as you can. You may have this great plan for the future that one day when your kids grow up, and that when you're enough funds for everybody, then you can actually just abandon everything and then just go off. Marvelous. Then you'd accept you. But of course, that's only advice. It's always different situations. Sometimes, you know, a grandfather was really wealthy. Sometimes you're not getting on well with your partner, whatever. But this is just advice. It's not telling you what to do, because I don't hold cups and I don't tell people what to do either. And when it gets to things like abortion, that again, telling another person what to do is totally impossible, because how on earth can I know, and how anyone else know, even if it's your best friend? They can never know how you feel and what's going on in your life. It's far too complex. So in ethical decisions, they should never be imposed from outside, which is why I'm really against all these laws which create fear and try and control people's choices. The United States, of all places, is supposed to be a free country, but there's so many choices which are made for you by others who don't really know what they're talking about. So, instead, a good friend is to help you make choices, but not make the choice for you. This is basic Buddhist law of karma. We are the owners of our karma. We take responsibility for our karma. We don't blame anybody. We're not told by other people. We're not ordered. This is not a control freak religion. It's to help you make wise choices for yourself. Help you. That's not controlling. And after you made that choice, whatever choice it is, the job of a good friend is to be with you, stand with you, no matter what choice you make. No guilt, no fear, no remorse, never looking back about what decision you made. Because, like, quite frankly, that I've been here for over 33 years now, sitting in this spot. Actually, this spot wasn't here 33 years ago, but the other temple as well. And so often, women have come up who've had abortions, and there's probably, I don't know, at least maybe half of the women here, if not more, had abortions, and because of the, please excuse me, the stupid society in which we live, you impose guilt upon the trauma already imposed upon you by losing a child. It's like a double whammy, and I just really get upset about that. There's a few things in my life which I think are just totally beyond the pale. And imposing guilt on a woman who's made one of the most difficult choices in her life to terminate a pregnancy, to me, imposing guilt, whoever imposes that guilt on them, that's bad karma. Any monk who says, a woman, you've terminated your pregnancy, you'll go to hell, that monk doesn't really deserve becoming a Buddhist monk. That's not true, and it also the cruelty of that. Maybe men maybe not haven't got enough empathy. Maybe I think you may have if you've been close to someone who's made that decision. It's agonizing, literally, thinking again and again, this way, that way, what should I do? Mainly we can walk away from that decision. Women can't. The being is growing hour by hour in their belly. It's a decision they have to make. So our job as friends, my job as a teacher, a religion's job as what's supposed to be compassionate guides, countries got jobs, government's jobs are supposed to care for the people. They should not make such harsh laws which just make the pain so much worse. But they should stand by people. Yes, give advice. Yes, give all sorts of opportunities for different ways of doing things. But in the end, whatever choice is made, we always stand by those people. When they need our help, our compassion,
our assistance, most of all, that's when we must be there. So it's not a case of blame game. In Buddhism, as I mentioned before, the law of karma is the old AFL rule. I mentioned AFL because that's the big football code here in Australia, Australian Football League, AFL. And in Buddhism, it means you acknowledge whatever's happened. So you never hide things. You never think, I can't tell people I've had an abortion. I can't tell people I'm gay. I can't tell people that I've got this, I'm taking medication because I've got a medical condition. When we stigmatize people like that, it just drives things deeper under the ground, creates huge psychological problems for people, which means that they can't enjoy happiness and peace in their life. So instead we acknowledge, allow it to come up to the surface, which means no stigmatism. Forgiveness, the F in the AFL code, forgive. Because you may not really understand just the difficulty of making that decision. You can't judge people. I find it impossible to judge others. Monks in my monastery, some of the stuff they get up to, I don't know why they did that. They must have had a reason at the time, but I couldn't really understand that. And it's such a beautiful thing to give forgiveness. It's not just for the person forgiving. What it is it's creating a fear-free society where we're not afraid of blame and guilt. It's amazing just how much guilt and grief is in our society. And you know that I used to go to Germany once a year to teach a retreat. And you know what, I was really shocked in Germany? That it was grandchildren of people from the Second World War. People who never knew any fighting. They also carried the guilt of their grandparents. Many of them. Because, you know, being a Buddhist monk, talking a lot to psychologists and therapists, they say you wouldn't believe just how many young people born 40, 50 years after the Second World War are still traumatized by that and feel this incredible guilt, which manifests in just lack of success in life, not able to hold a relationship and enjoy the love of another person, and not able to be feeling at peace with yourself. Not the first generation. I can sort of understand the first generation, but the second generation, it's a guilt-ridden society. And they've got nothing to be guilty about. They never fought in the war. They were just the children of the children of the people who fought in that war. And anyway, the Brits were as bad as the Germans, all bad as each other in wars. You can't blame one side. Only the trouble is the people who win, we're the good guys, and the ones who lose are the bad guys. And it's just really unfair. So, anyway, when it comes down to the guilt, it's something which creates huge amounts of problems in our society, even economic problems. I'm sure that if we didn't have so much guilt in our society, so much fear, the GDP would be much better and the government would be much happier. Mr. Turnbull would probably not lose his job. But because of fear, guilt, it just has huge implications on all parts of our society, simply because we don't forgive enough. And if we can receive forgiveness from someone else, maybe then we can learn how to forgive ourselves as well. We're not so bad. What was that case many years ago, counseling this one lady here in Nolamara? She was had cancer, she was dying, nothing much you could really do except make sure she has a good death. So I was counseling her every Friday. I got to the point where she trusted me. I don't think she should have actually, but anyway, she trusted me. And then I asked her, you know, she was maybe in her early 70s, and I said, what's the worst thing you've ever done in your life? What's the worst thing? Come on, you can tell me. I won't tell anybody. that was my intention at the time, but afterwards I thought, no, I'm telling everybody this. And I don't think she would mind. Now, what?
She'd lived a long life. What's the worst thing you've ever done in her life, in your life? And it took a while to get it out of her. And she said, you know, once my husband wasn't around, and I kissed another woman's husband. I kissed him. And then I said to her, is that all? Is that the worst thing you've ever done? You know, just one kiss to another woman's husband. And you know, once she brought it up and told me and saw my reaction, she realized it wasn't such a bad thing after all. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a thing you should do. As soon as you go home tonight, please go and kiss someone else's husband. That's not what I mean. But what I mean is, well, that's not that bad. In a whole lifetime, that's the worst thing you've done. That's a pretty good life. But when she didn't acknowledge it, when she felt so guilty about it, the guilt just made that, you know, be like almost like, you know, adultery, like paedophilia, like the worst possible sin she could possibly do. She felt so bad about it because she never let people know. That's because of fear and guilt. So it's one of the reasons why people have had abortions. Be proud of it. It's who you are. Let people know. Don't be stigmatized by it. You know, it's part of your life. You made a decision, and I am not capable of saying right decision or wrong decision. Basically, you're not either. No way you can say right or wrong, simply because the ethical considerations are way too complex. And I know many people who have thought, well, you know, this is a life. In Buddhism, we look at life in a different way. Because, yeah, maybe you had an abortion, and that being never came into your life, yet. Maybe it comes later on. Has another go. Because it's not as if you only have one chance to get born into this life. And the classic story which I tell was of a couple who come here. They're not here this evening, thank goodness. They get embarrassed, but their first child was stillborn. 5 days before birth, she had ultrasound, perfect. The pregnancy was going perfectly, but in the last 5 days before birth, apparently the fetus, the embryo, whatever it's called, had actually turned around in the womb and had cut off the blood supply in the umbilical cord, so it was stillborn. It was a great tragedy, but being Buddhist, they took it well. And at the funeral, which was done up in Wanneroo Road in Barono Days, I was there, I did the chanting for everybody, and while my head was turned, they got a ballpoint pen and drew a line on their baby's heel. She was a healthy woman. A few months later, she got pregnant again. And she gave birth to a healthy young girl with a birthmark on the heel of a line exactly where they had drawn it with a ballpoint pen. Come back again. Didn't make it first time, but you know, in life, you always give another go. You know, what is the lady here? She'd be embarrassed, but 16 times she failed her English test to get her visa. 16 times she failed. But then she came to Ajahn Brahm, did some chanting, and the 17th time she made it. And I told her off, you should have come to me the first time. But we always have another try at these things, driving test or, you know, your grade 12s or universities. We always have second chances, so why not in life? Now that's a true story of somebody who just, you know, just almost made it into this world but didn't quite, and had another go. You know how a lot of time that happens with abortions as well? For some reason it's not really the time. The karma is not all there. Sometimes it just doesn't happen. But don't think that you're denying that being a life. You're delaying it. Now, if you put it that way,
That helps take a lot of the guilt and fear out of that terrible thing which women have to do, abortions. So even don't call it terminating a pregnancy. Call it delaying the pregnancy. Put it in a different terms, and it takes a lot of the sharpness which hurts people so deeply. And of course, even so, that just losing a kid is just such an important, it's part of you. As a woman, look, empathizing, I really try hard to get my head into women's heads, gays' heads, I'm a monk, anybody's heads, to try and get and feel what it's like. Imagine it, visualize it, what it's like, a being, part of you, but different from you, growing inside of you. Amazing, just every day, every moment, feeling this thing develop inside of you. And then having to make this terrible, terrible decision to terminate it. Imagine, just, it's not just a small decision. For months this has been happening, for weeks. And then suddenly that it's just intolerable for whatever reason, and you have to make that decision. And when you do, you need friends. You need people right beside you. Not to make it more difficult, it's too difficult already. To say, chances are, we'll come back again. Number two is, it's the only thing you could do. No fear, no blame. Forgive, 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 which is part of love. You know, in the old days, let's go back, because much of this is coming from Christianity in the United States. You know, that old saying, I think it was from Jesus, let he who has not sinned cast the first stone. But everybody casts stones at each other, blaming and making sort of people's lives miserable. What it means is that we all make mistakes. That's what I understand that Christian saying, that those without sin cast the first stone, is there is no people like that. We all make mistakes, and so we should acknowledge that and just forgive and learn and grow, because that's the last part of the AFL code, acknowledge, forgive, and learn. You got yourself in a difficult situation. Now learn not to get in that difficult situation again, if at all possible. But don't go around sort of blaming yourself or blaming other people. But in particular, when that decision is so limited, that freedom is curtailed by laws of people who really don't know what they're talking about. Maybe based on a book whose use-by date expired long, long, long ago. It doesn't really make any sense to me, and it's harmful. Because I've unfortunately dealt with too many women who have been traumatized by the guilt, which they was totally unnecessary, which comes around things like abortion. Buddhists sometimes say, but it's killing a life. Killing is bad karma. Don't be so simplistic. Life is nuanced. It'll always be nuanced. And this was something which changed my way of looking at this. Because I was visiting my mother in UK many years ago, and while she was in UK, I was just spending time having a cup of tea. She had the news on the TV. Don't mind watching the news. And I was actually very grateful to watch the news here, because one of the news segments was of an ethical dilemma which was happening in a hospital in Wales. There was a woman who was pregnant with two children. And I don't know what the condition was. I'm not a doctor of medicine, but all these specialists were totally convinced, no doubt at all, if they did nothing at all, the mother and those two babies in her womb would all die. There was no doubt at all. But if they aborted one of those kids in her womb, just one, the mother and the other child would live. Absolutely certain. And the ethical decision was, should you abort one of those kids so the mother and the other kid would live, or just let nature take its course which would mean all three died. If you are the doctor, not just a bystander, that is duty. That is a decision you can't really put off. But before the doctor made the decision, the doctor in charge, it was debated. As a Buddhist, if you were that doctor, what would you do? Put your hands up now if you say you do nothing. Put your hands up if you would kill one of those babies so the other one would survive and the mother would live. I'm joining you. If I was a doctor, that's what I would do. And for me, that is an ethical imperative there, to care. To care the least of the two bad options. And while they were debating, many fundamentalist religious leaders, I don't know if there was Buddhists involved in there, but certainly many of the Christians, were there, no, that's God's choice, you shouldn't play God. Abortion is always wrong, killing is always wrong, but look at that, and that's what I would have to do if I was a doctor, not a monk. So you can see that sometimes these questions of ethics are just so nuanced. You cannot just rely upon just even things like precepts. Precepts are your guides. I always call these precepts in Buddhism, like any other moral code, red traffic lights. Red traffic lights, when you go home this evening, please stop at the red traffic lights. The reason is to go through them is dangerous. It's against the law. Except if I had a heart attack right now and you put me in your car to take me to the hospital, please go through the red traffic lights. If it's safe. And of course, if you got stopped by the police and it was a real emergency, they wouldn't prosecute you. But what I'd hope you would do, you wouldn't just speed through the traffic lights, you would stop, make sure it was safe, and then go through. Red traffic lights are like precepts. Stop. Is it really important? Is it an emergency? And number two, is it safe to go through? Sometimes it is safe and it's the right thing to do in emergencies. Ajahn Bum having a heart attack. I hope, please. That's why I'm saying this, just in case. No, I'm really very healthy. So, this is what ethics are. You cannot just have a rule and just keep to it every time. Because life is not like that. Life is so nuanced, and you have to feel it in your heart. Feel what is right, feel what is wrong. And a lot of time it's so obvious. Sometimes the rules are what confuse us. Fear instead of wisdom. So blame instead of kindness. Understanding, that is a path of Buddhism, and supporting, being kind. So that's one of the reasons why that sometimes I think the less laws the better. Okay, we have to have some laws sometimes, but please apply them with kindness, like we do in monastery. Monk breaks the rule. And the monks here next to me know this. Our job is not to punish, but to be kind. Learn. Why did you do that? See if make sure you don't do it again. Okay? You can go. Because the last story, just before I go, just to make it a little bit more fun. There was a trainee in my monastery who came to see me one morning. He felt so guilty. He said, I didn't sleep all last night. I'd done a terrible crime. And so what do you do? And he said, last night, I was hungry. And I made myself a sandwich. And I ate it. And I know we're not supposed to eat afternoon. But I did. I'm so sorry. And he felt so guilty. And you can see just the written all over his face. I said, so what I told him, I said, number one,
well done, you've told me. That's an important thing to do, just to acknowledge it, bring it up. And number two, you know, it's okay, you know, people make mistakes. Number three, learn. Look, there's all these other things a monk or a nun can eat in the afternoon. You wouldn't believe what we can eat and still get around the rules. There's so many loopholes. Chocolate, cheese, honey, juices. You can make a meal out of some of the stuff we can eat. So I said, eat that stuff instead. I said, you can go now. And he said, what? What? You're not going to punish me? I said, no, we don't do punishments in Buddhism. But you have to, he said, you have to. If you don't give me a punishment, I know I will do it again tomorrow. You know, some people are like that. So, oh, crikey, what can I do with this guy? So I said, okay, I've got a punishment for you. Because that day, that morning, I'd been reading a history book about Australia and the punishments they gave to the convicts in the early years. The cat of nine tails. The whip. So I said, well, this is Australia, and Buddhism does have to adapt. So if you want a punishment, I will give you 50 strokes of the cat. And this guy, he didn't really have much idea what Buddhism was. And his face really went white. You know what happens when people are afraid? Their lips start to quiver. He really thought that I was going to whip him. And then I had to tell him what 50 strokes of the cat means in a Buddhist monastery. At that time, we had two cats. Please find one of them and stroke it. One, two, three. And learn some kindness, because that was his weakness. He wasn't kind. If he could learn some compassion from stroking a cat, then maybe he could learn some compassion to himself and forgive. So any lady here, any woman who feels really guilty because they have given abortion, the sentence is 50 strokes of the cat for every abortion. Find a cat, put it in your lap, and stroke it. And this is the penance from Ajahn Brahm. Thank you for listening. Okay. If you don't like cats, a dog will do, or a rabbit, whatever you've got. Okay, we've got any questions? From the floor, they're just still arranging things up in that little room over there. Any questions from anybody here? About making ethical... Oh, we've got some questions over here. Here's what we've got. See what we've got here today? Yeah, come on. Okay. Okay, who we got today? Okay, the first one is... from the Pope. Ajahn Brahm, can you please tell people that abortion is evil? Signed P-O-P-E. No, it's not the Pope. I'm going to get into big trouble one day. Okay. First of all, can you advise on parents not putting their fears in the way of kids growing up? Giving kids the freedom so they can try to live up to their full potential. Oh, that's so important for parenting. For parents, I mean, if you know some parents here, if you're not a parent, one day you probably will be. And it's important to trust your kids. Is she here today? No, good. There was, when I was over in England, met one of these little kids who I've known since he was this high. Really successful doctor. Doing really good work over in the UK, you know, volunteering, just a beautiful girl. But when she was young, she asked her mum, she said, Mum, you know, I'm going out tonight. Where are you going? Going to the nightclub. Nightclub? You can't go to the nightclub. You know, in nightclubs, people drink. You know, in nightclubs, they have drugs. You know, in nightclubs, they have a good time. And so she came to see me and said, oh, my kids want to go to the nightclub. What should I do? I said, let them go. Trust them. Just tell them just the dangers. You know, don't take any drugs. You don't need drugs to be happy. You know, alcohol, you know, please don't take that also. But have a good time. And she trusted her kids because I advised her to. And kids turned out to be brilliant kids because they were trusted. They lived up to their parents' trust. If you didn't trust them, they say, oh, I'm just going out to the Buddhist society tonight. And they come in here so they don't lie, and then they go to the nightclub afterwards. So I didn't lie, Mum, I did go to the Buddhist society, and then the nightclub. Which means the kids will do this anyway, but just please trust them. And don't put the fear in the way of the kids. Obviously there's some fears, like drugs cause a huge amount of trouble, so not really fear, but just knowledge, wisdom, so they can look after themselves. And again, kids do make mistakes, and they learn from the mistakes. My father would always say, this is where I got the story from, door of my heart's always open to you, no matter what you do. Just now, how many mistakes you make, how bad you turn out to be, you're my son, I'll always love you. And that was really powerful. Amazing, it just makes me emotional even now thinking about that. Not putting fear in the way of the kid, but putting this unconditional love in their hearts from the parents. That works. Next one, I was desperate after a relationship breakup. I'm meditating and that helps, but that desperation still haunts me. What should I do? Look, if a relationship breaks up, it's really painful. But please know that if you are single, you have what we call in Buddhism single person suffering. If you find a partner again, you will have having a partner suffering. It's just a different flavor of suffering, that's all. But don't think that if you find a relationship again, it will be all happiness. It's always things are difficult. So after a relationship breakup, number one, please don't blame anybody, certainly not yourself. It's not your fault. It's called impermanence. It's a law of nature. Some relationships last a long time, some a short time. It's life. So it's normal. Nothing wrong with your partner, nothing wrong with you. It just got to its use-by date. It expired. So you can't do anything about that. If you've got a carton of milk and it's expired and gone off, you don't think, oh, why did this happen to me? No, you go to Coles and get another carton of milk. So your relationship has gone off. It's gone sour. So, yeah, instead of getting negative about it, blaming, learn from it. You learn from your relationships, and you grow so much, you know, from just sharing your life with another person, how difficult it is, but how much you can grow and learn from that. And next time, you do it even better. Until you become an expert on relationships, which means you have a long one, very fulfilling. So learn from it. Lastly, Jack from the United States, I think, a synonym for Donald. Donald from the United States. Oh, one day it's going to happen. Probably it's not Donald. How do you manage to live as a Buddhist when all your friends and family do not think you have it in you to become peaceful, and they continue to test your limits? You don't need to be peaceful to be a Buddhist. People actually have all these ideas what a Buddhist should be, and sometimes your kids give you hell for that. Daddy, Buddhists are not supposed to get angry. Yes, you are. You can get angry. So tell your kids, no, Ajahn Brahm said, Mummy is allowed to get angry at you, so look out, kid. Buddhists are supposed to let go, so let me go to the nightclub and get drunk. No, that's not what Ajahn Brahm said letting go means. So a lot of times your friends haven't got a clue what a Buddhist is. So, you know, just you can get some nice rejoinders saying, you haven't got it in yourself to become peaceful. And you can say to yourself, no, Mum, no, Dad. I'm being angry at you on purpose. I really am peaceful inside. But if I didn't get angry from time to time, that would make me feel so superior to you. that I get angry from time to time, just out of compassion, so you don't feel so hopeless in my presence, in my holy presence. And yes, I am really holy and peaceful and very, very wise, but I'm so humble I don't want to tell you anything. So this is just an act which I put on for my humility in your presence, family. Or whatever, make it up as you go along. But you haven't got it in you to become peaceful. Of course you have. There's all these incredible stories of the people who did become enlightened in the time of the Buddha. There was the serial killer. A serial killer became a disciple of the Buddha and Gulimala and became fully enlightened. And if anyone didn't have it in him, you would think that person didn't. Serial killer become fully enlightened? Did. So, do you think serial killers have it in them to become Buddhist? Honestly, think about it. Does Donald Trump have it in him to become a Buddhist? Of course he does. Anyone can. Just needs to listen to a few of my talks and... Who knows? Anyway, so anyone can become a Buddhist. It's just a training. You just learn. In Buddhism, what Buddhism says, that you can be anything you want. It's amazing. You can be peaceful. You don't have to change yourself. That's impossible. But change your attitude. That's possible. And that's what Buddhism does. Totally change your attitudes. It's so easy to do when you change the right thing, not the wrong thing. And then you can be a really great Buddhist. So, for Jack in the United States, tell them to listen to my talks, and then they'll find that you have it in you to be a great Buddhist, and so does your family and friends. Da da da. Okay, so I think I've gone over time again, so thank you all for listening. So now we can do the Arahang Sammasambuddha. If you have any questions, please come up afterwards to ask.